Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Jane Donahue. Today we continue our annual broadcast presentations from the College of the Atlantic Summer Institute in Bar Harbor, Maine. Every year, the College of the Atlantic Summer Institute invites speakers to address a topic relevant to our times. This year's theme was Pathbreaking: Pioneers, Leaders, Innovators. Today we bring you the third episode of our six-part series, a conversation between pathbreaking investigative reporter Patrick Radden Keefe and executive editor Daniel Zalewski from The New Yorker. In December of 1972, a 38-year-old mother of 10 was abducted from her Belfast home, driven across the border into the Republic of Ireland, and murdered. Her kidnapping and death remained a mystery until Patrick Radden Keefe investigated, bringing her story to light in his bestseller, Say Nothing, a true story of memory and murder in Northern Ireland. This talk was recorded live on July 30th, 2025, and has been edited for broadcast. We begin with an introduction from College of the Atlantic President, Dr. Sylvia Torti.
It's so nice to feel the energy inside this tent pulse two times per day. It almost feels to me like we're breathing a lung, we're a lung in and out. And in many ways, I feel like it has been that. I've certainly been energized, maybe oxygenated is the right word, by the stories of pathbreaker leaders. I was thinking on my way up here this evening that while we've heard about pathbreaking leadership in quite various fields, from art to science to political movements, all of the leaders and speakers have shared a couple of traits: conviction of idea, persistence, and patience, but also a great deal of collaborative discourse. And this is what I really love about the College of Atlantic Summer Institute: the collaboration, the conversations that happen in here more formally, and that in the Gyro Oval afterwards. And I can assure you that these types of conversations happen all year long here on campus. Our students respectfully agree and disagree with one another, and often with me. So now I'd like to invite you to settle in. We've got a great lineup this afternoon in back-to-back sessions. First, I'd like to welcome Nick Pomegarten to the podium. Nick is a staff writer at The New Yorker whose work I've long admired. He's also a longtime summer resident on MDI, and we are honored to have him at the COA Summer Institute for the first time. Welcome.
Hello, everybody. It's an honor to be here on this beautiful afternoon and to have you all here. Thanks for coming out. And it's also an honor for me to be on the stage with these two gentlemen, who I am very fortunate to have been able to call colleagues and friends for many, many years. They are both top of the line writers, editors, and dudes. So Patrick first. I was talking to an editor like a year ago at The New Yorker, and he sort of enumerated the traits that a proper New Yorker editor, a New Yorker writer would need in order to perform his or her job. And you would need like two out of three of them. One was you have to be able to report. The next was you have to be able to think. And the third was you have to be able to write. I would say most of us at The New Yorker have one or two of those traits. I won't tell you which two I think I have, or one and a half. But Patrick is that rare triple threat. He does all of those things extremely well. But of course, the real source of the power of his work is his reporting. He is a relentless, insatiable reporter. I would even use the word unstoppable. I think the Sacklers might agree. But so everything for Patrick springs from this desire to find things out. But what he really brings to it, the writing part and the thinking part, is turning those things into stories, into narratives that are compelling, that go down easy, but convey a lot of complexity. We're talking about Say Nothing today, or they are supposed to talk about Say Nothing. And it is obviously a groundbreaking work of history. It's a testament to great reportage, but it's a story. It's a great story. Now, the word storytelling gets thrown around a lot, and it's kind of trendy, and it's usually annoying when people refer to, you know, like a brownie mix as some kind of a story. They use storytelling to define everything. But he is a true storyteller, and it's the good stuff. He's the real thing. And Say Nothing is one of the best books, certainly nonfiction books, that I've read in decades. I consider it a masterpiece, a true masterpiece, and it is very hard for one writer to say that to another writer. He's good, goddammit. Now, Daniel is an editor. He toils in silence, in obscurity, anonymity, selflessness. Most of you probably don't know who he is, but he's real good. And I can tell you, among the writers and editors at The New Yorker, we all know he's a genius, one of the best in the business. What an editor does, the way it works in The New Yorker, is an editor has a stable of writers. Daniel's stable includes Patrick, obviously, but it also includes Jane Mayer. Who else? David Gran, Ian Parker. So he has some real superstars. Their superstardom may or may not have a lot to do with the work he's done for them. Certainly not your work, Patrick. But I am not one of the writers in his stable. I have only been edited once by Daniel, and that was 30 years ago, almost to the day. He was a young editor at Lingua Franca. I was writing a story about Bennington College, some drama there, Troubles of Another Kind. And it was my first time ever writing a long story. I turned in a mess to him, an absolute mess. I remember the look on his face when I came to the office. There was a sort of look of pity that a midwit such as myself had taken on this line of work. There was no thinking, no writing, no reporting. It was just none of it. I've learned some things since then, but I'm in some ways glad that he's not my editor, because he's tough. I was talking to David Gran about Daniel recently, and he told me, David Gran, one of his writers, that the first story he did for Daniel, Daniel had a note, a query on every sentence in the piece. You know, death by 1,000 queries. Now, you know, he thought it was a really bad thing. Now, of course, David Gran is a gajillionaire living in some, you know, castle somewhere. The greatest success. So that's Daniel. Daniel's wonderful. You're very lucky to have him here, too, and to have these two men talk about their craft. I'm even going to stay around and listen to it, because I want to hear what it's like for them to be in that dark room alone, you know, tangling over ideas, reporting, and writing. And now you get to do it. They get to do it in public. So here, without further ado, are these two fine gentlemen.
Thank you, Nick. Patrick is indeed somebody who not only just reports well, but is a master storyteller. But that notion of unfolding a narrative through reporting, it all begins in many ways with the idea for a story. And the thing about a truly masterly journalist is that you don't jump necessarily at the first time you have a thought about a subject that interests you and say, I'm going to do that story and I'm going to publish it in 2 months. And I know, you know, I'm just going to dive into that cold water. Sometimes the very best projects that a writer may do is something that you may be thinking about for a third of your life. You know, you've lived this kind of preoccupation, but you've been waiting for the right door to be there to say, now, instead of just treating it like a scholarly paper or a subject about which I'm just kind of going to conquer it through reading and willpower alone, I'm going to find that moment, that story that I see out there that kind of makes me realize, like, I have a way in. And I feel with Say Nothing in particular, there was a way where you kind of, you know, this Patrick grew up in Dorchester in Massachusetts. The idea of sort of Northern Ireland and the Troubles was something that, like, his family talked about, relatives talked about, neighbors talked about. It's kind of part of the ambient sort of background of your life. You were always curious. What is the moment I know it, but you tell everyone here. What's the moment when you realize, like, I think I have a way to tell this story differently than it has been told previously?
Yeah, good question. Thank you, Nick, for the introduction. Thank you, Daniel, for being here. Thank you all for coming. It is a real treat to be with you. What a beautiful place. And I'm particularly happy to be talking with Daniel. 20 years ago this fall, I sent him a pitch. And this was not my first pitch to The New Yorker, but it was the first one that was accepted. And we've been working together ever since. So it's a real privilege to get to talk here on this stage with all of you, with somebody I work so closely with and who's been so responsible for so much of what has worked about my work over the years. I grew up in Boston, as Daniel mentioned, and my dad, who's an Irish-American guy from Boston, when he would get the Boston Globe in the morning and have his coffee at our kitchen table in Dorchester, he would open up the Globe, and the first thing he would turn to is the obituary page, which he referred to as the Irish sports pages. And he loved, in the morning, to start the day by reading about all the people who had died in the previous days for whatever reason. And I inherited this tendency from him, and I find the obituary page is sometimes a good place to look for ideas, because an obituary as a literary form is kind of an amazing thing, right? It's like this little 700, 800,000 word distillation of a life. And sometimes it's a big person who you were familiar with, and a lot of the time it's not. And I think there's real literary artistry that happens on the obituary page. And in this case, in 2013, it's crazy to think it was this long ago, I opened the New York Times and I turned to the obituary page and I read an obituary of a woman named Dolores Price. And my book, which I think they have over there, it's actually Dolores Price's image on the cover of the book. I had not heard of her, though she was a fairly well-known figure in Northern Ireland. But it said that this was a woman who was the first woman to join the IRA as a kind of frontline soldier, carrying a gun, leading operations. Women had been involved in the Irish Republican Army, but not in that kind of active capacity. And she had become this kind of iconic figure in the 1970s. She joined with her sister, Marion. They went off and bombed London. They bombed the Old Bailey in 1973. She was captured. She went on hunger strike. She almost died. And eventually, when she got out of prison, she married a movie star. She married Stephen Ray, the actor some of you may remember from The Crying Game and other films. And what really intrigued me was that it said in this obituary that in middle age, she started to have some misgivings about things that she had done in her youth. So this was the first thing that really intrigued me, was the idea of, you know, what happens when a radical isn't martyred and they actually grow up and they have children of their own and the conflict ends? How do they look back on the things they did in their 20s? That was really interesting to me. And then this obituary mentioned another woman whose name I didn't know, a woman named Jean McConville, who was a Belfast mother. She was a widow and a mother of 10. So her husband had died, she had 10 kids. And in 1972, she was abducted from her home in Belfast by the IRA and taken away and never seen again. So her children grew up orphaned and they didn't know what happened to their mother. And it was a terrible war crime during a terrible conflict. But people remembered this name, Jean McConville. And this obituary suggested that one of the things that Dolores Price had misgivings about was that she had somehow been involved in the abduction and disappearance of that woman back in 1972. So the way this whole thing started for me was the idea of these two very different women. I had thought of The Troubles as a very male story, and here were these two women with these very different backgrounds, one of them a perpetrator, one of them a victim, and the idea that they were joined by this act of violence. And that felt irresistible as a story, what I initially thought would be a magazine article and then became a book and more recently has become a television drama. That was the thing that pulled me in.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it was important when you first spoke to me about the story, You know, and I remember seeing that photograph of Dolores Price, who, you know, was just very, you know, seductive looking, and there was this kind of youthful, like, charisma as well as kind of ferocity to her that kind of just really conveyed that, you know, she was a figure about one would feel a kind of electric ambivalence, you know, both that she was fighting for a cause that she believed in and that she had also maybe perhaps participated in things in which she'd gotten over her head. I mean, when you're a youthful radical and when you're, you know, think of all the other conflicts that we know of in the world when we kind of think of how much of the conflict and violence is led by young people who are overwhelmed by their both political feelings and their emotions. And it kind of, you know, is this force that, like, is more than them. You know, I think you knew that there would be a complexity and a kind of drama to her, both in just accounting what she did, but that kind of hindsight. And, you know, if you read both Say Nothing and if you watch the television series, you'll see it's very important that it has a kind of double narrative. It's both the kind of, you know, the account of the period of the Troubles itself. But then there are biographers and historians who are meeting with Dolores and kind of talking to her. And it's actually her memory of being somebody who would, like, hold up banks for the cause. And you feel both that she's Bonnie and Clyde and that she's a terrorist. And, like, did you ever resolve that feeling of ambivalence yourself about her kind of moral status? You know, she, in some ways, you know, most people who talk about someone like Dolores Price, if you support the IRA, you think of her as a hero. You know, you get to marry a movie star. Other people think of her as just a cold-blooded killer. You know, what did you ever get to resolve that as you began this journey of reporting?
No, I mean, I think what appealed to me was precisely the complexity, and I do, you know, as you said, I sort of grew up with a you know, I grew up in if you know Boston, I grew up in Dorchester. My, you know, my father used to go down and drink at the Erie Pub down the street, and they passed the hat at the Erie Pub for the IRA. You know, they would pass a jar around and say, "We're raising money for the lads." And that, in my neighborhood growing up, like, that was the perspective on the IRA, was like, we applaud what they are doing. They are heroes unequivocally. We will give our own money to buy guns, and, you know, the materials will be made to make bombs that are all of the bloodshed is going to happen somewhere else. It's going to happen across an ocean. But we feel so devoted to this cause, you know, not devoted enough to, like, go ourselves and put our own families at risk, but enough, you know, devoted enough to put $20 in the jar. So that's one perspective.
Do you remember that just as a child? Do you remember having any sense of discomfort with that?
Well, there's a famous story in my family, which is that my parents met in England. My mother's Australian. And my dad went to Oxford after he went, you know, went to Fordham for college. And then he went to Oxford for a couple of years. And he met my mother there. And they have these very dear friends. There's this English guy whose name is Ron Scott. And there's a famous story in my family about, this is probably in the 1980s, Ron Scott coming to stay with us in Dorchester and my dad taking him for a beer at the Erie Pub, and Ron Scott, their English friend, sitting there, and somebody, apparently not having heard his accent, coming and shaking the jar in his face. And what's Ron Scott gonna do? You know, the Englishman at the Erie Pub. And so, just to be polite, he put $5 in the jar, right? Like, these are the kinds of stories that I grew up around, and of course there was an ambivalence that was felt. But the kind of tribalism on display there was something I was skeptical about from a pretty early age. And I lived in England, and I saw a very different, I lived in England myself for a few years, saw a very different perspective on the IRA, but also a perspective that I thought was, like, too monochromatic to be particularly credible, right? Which is that these are all psychopaths. Britain is blameless in this history. You know, we have been victimized by the IRA. If you'll indulge me with a quick aside, just to give you a sense of the kinds of stories that appeal to me and also Daniel's role in these types of things. There's a piece that I wrote in 2014, which was an idea that Daniel had. And it was about a woman named Amy Bishop, who had grown up in Braintree, Massachusetts, And she went to Harvard. She got a PhD. She became a professor at the University of Alabama in Huntsville. And in 2010, she went into a faculty meeting and pulled out a gun and shot six of her colleagues, killing three of them. And at the time, there was a lot of press coverage about this. And the idea was, you know, it was sort of the nutty professor. Like, she hadn't gotten tenure. It was a woman who was a mass shooter, which was unusual. But it emerged that in the 1980s, she had actually shot and killed her little brother in Braintree with a shotgun. And there was this episode where there were only two kids in the family, and in the kitchen of the family home in Braintree, Amy kills her brother Seth at point blank range with a shotgun. And there's one witness. It's their mother, Judy. Judy comes into the kitchen. She sees her daughter kill her son. The cops are on the way. And when they get there, Judy says, "I saw the whole thing. It was an accident." And there's never any real investigation. Amy's never arrested. Everybody just kind of turns away. And Amy moves on in her life. Nothing goes on her permanent record. And she ends up years later in Huntsville shooting six people. Now, when Daniel initially asked me about this, I said, "I'm not interested in doing that story because Amy Bishop sounds like a psycho, and I don't really care that much about the psychology of a mass shooter. That's not that interesting to me." And Daniel said, "No, the story's not Amy. The story is her mother. The story is Judy. The story is the parent who has two kids, and she sees one kill the other, and she's about to lose her remaining child, and she has to make a choice about what she tells the police." And it may be that I was myself a new parent at the time, but that sort of opened a window for me into seeing, I guess,
and I remember having that feeling of, you know, people sometimes think that journalists see it as their job to just, you know, be professional scolds and judge and juries of, you know, the people that they write about. But I think it, as a magazine journalist and somebody who's interested in narrative and psychology and character, I'm most interested in stories about people about whom we can identify something. And so it's not a mere act of judgment. And, you know, what mother doesn't want to protect a child, even a wayward child, even a mentally ill child? And then these circumstances happen, and then it blows up in their faces 15 years later. That's the kind of tragedy that you can both judge the mother for, but you can also have incredible sympathy for. And I think that, you know, and it lets you see, like, what a culture of guns can do, you know, without doing yet another story that says guns are bad and we need gun control. So I think, you know, to talk about Say Nothing again, I think part, you know, there is this woman who ended up dead as part of the Troubles with, you know, 10 children. And, you know, when you think again of like the IRA and Patrick being kind of told, you know, this is a freedom fighter group. And then you think, and yet there is this woman, you know, 10 orphans, you know, what must it have been like to bend that family and how did they perceive it? I will tell you one reason why I thought he should be doing this story, ended up doing the book, is, when in there's an obituary, there is, and then there's this abiding mystery about what happened to this woman that no one has been able to solve to this day. Not only with the Amy Bishop story did Patrick do a much better job than the local police ever did in like fully running down what awful thing had happened back in the 1980s with Amy Bishop, but there's a leap of faith that any magazine editor or publication must take when you say, are you going to spend 6 months, you know, trying to find out what happened to Jean McConville? And I felt very confident that Patrick, who really could have been a prosecutor, could have been a detective, could have been all those things rolled in one, had he wanted to.
Professional basketball player.
No, not that. Not
rock
that.
Rock star.
No, it's only those things. There is a kind of, you know, sort of, you know, a moral Javert quality to him in which, you know, when he feels that the reporting has a purpose and a moral point, there is nothing that will stop in his way. And you know, he does it ethically. He doesn't cut any corners. But you ask the awkward question. You keep going. You go to the archive. you know, even people who are suffering 30 years later after a terrible incident like the death of Jean McConville, people who don't want to talk about it. I mean, the book is called Say Nothing for a reason, because there was a culture of silence about the misdeeds, if you want to call it that, of the IRA that really made it an absolute act of breaking omerta to talk about it. Patrick did that again and again. Like, there's actually a great story you had once about, like, when you kind of walked into, you know, it's like one of the bars or sort of like in Belfast, I think it was, and you kind of wanted to, you know, sort of talk to people about this, and they just kind of stared you down, and you kind of had to kind of walk out. Do you remember this?
Yeah. Which, I mean, I'm trying to remember. There are a number of these stories.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there was one where I, if it's the one that I think you're referring to, which is a funny story, there's a guy named Brennan Hughes, who's a character in the book, and a big figure in the IRA. He was very close with Jerry Adams. He was, who we'll be, I'm sure, hearing about shortly. He was a kind of fearsome commander in the IRA, and he went on hunger strike and plays a big role in the book. And he's dead now. He was dead when I started working, but his brother was still alive. And I went to see his brother. And his brother asked to meet in this little town, kind of right near the Irish border, in kind of no man's land. And it turned out that when I got there, it wasn't even a town. It was just a pub. There was like nothing for miles around but just this pub. And I went in, and he said, why don't we sit out front? There was a picnic table out front, but he said, you go get us some Guinness, and we'll sit out front and do the interview. And so I sort of creaked open the door, and inside the pub were these, like, you know, fairly intimidating-looking guys who didn't know who I was, didn't like the look of me. I'm there with my notebook. I'm meeting with Brennan Hughes's brother. I bring our drinks out, we sit down, but I notice that they're looking out the window at us because we're sitting like right in front of the pub. And we talk and talk, and he finishes his drink and he sends me in for another one. And I go in, and this time they're really, you know, kind of giving me the hairy eyeball. And I bring the drink out, I keep talking. You know, I'm interviewing about all this kind of IRA, fairly sensitive stuff. And the third time around, when I go in for beers, I'm coming out, and they one by one they walk out after me, and there's like a semicircle of guys standing around us, and one of them asks where I'm from and what I'm doing, and you know, I'm in an interview, what's this all about? And then one of them says, where are you staying? And I say, oh, I'm staying in Dublin. And he says, oh yeah, which hotel? And at this point, I'm thinking it's probably time to get out of here. And so I start packing up my stuff, and I say, oh, guys, I got to go. Sun's going down. Got to get back to Dublin. And I run around to my little rental car, and I get into the rental car and close the door and let out this big sigh of relief. And then I look, and I'm looking at the dashboard because the steering wheel in Ireland is on the other side, and I have gotten in the wrong side of the car. And there's this just like mortifying moment when my eyes are closed and I look up and the six guys are just like cracking up. They think this is the funniest thing they've ever seen. And I have to open up the door and say, all right, guys, I'm really going now. And I go around the car and I take off. So yeah, a lot of moments like that.
I love that story, not only because it humiliates Patrick, no, but because it actually shows one of the great benefits of doing on the ground reporting, not just scholarship about an event in recent history, because when I heard that story, I remember thinking, you know, a lot of the violence again, and a lot of the strategy making, a lot of the plotting, the comradeship of the IRA was a bunch of young people hanging out, often in bars. And you want to capture that. And one of the great things about Say Nothing, even though it's very honest about the lives that were lost, and just to kind of catch up with something I said earlier, he solves the murder of Jean McConville in this book. I'm not going to tell you who did it, but we've already mentioned the name. And I think that when you actually kind of hang out among people for whom this is like their living cultural legacy, it helps you not only judge them, but help animate them as characters. And someone like Brendan Hughes, both in the book and if you watch the television show, he's an incredibly charismatic figure in that television show. I think half the people who watch it would be what my my colleague and friend Emily Nussbaum, a television critic, calls the bad fan, meaning when you watch Tony Soprano, you want to be him instead of, you know, arrest him. And, you know, the Brendan Hughes character, who is just, you know, valiant, an incredible pal to everyone, you know, hiding out in this kind of, you know, dramatic way in other people's houses, dashing from house to house to evade the police. You know, what fun in a way, like who wouldn't want to be doing this when you're 20? And yet there's this dark moral undertow through all of it. And I think in some ways that's the real triumph of the book, even though it kind of puts you with this band of, you know, young people who are engaging in everything from robberies to hunger strikes, it makes you feel what it would be like to be somebody whose political drive, you know, pushes you to extremities in a small community where you all agree that that not only makes sense, but that is the meaning of life. And I just wondered, like, you know, how did it feel like to meet people who had actually not just, you know, you were not just meeting fellow scholars, but people who had actually participated in this rebellion?
Yeah, I mean, a few different things. So one is that the I do think there's no substitute for going out and being in a place and meeting the people there. You will sometimes, it's you know, less so now, but up until a few years ago, you would occasionally hear people suggest that, like, a writer isn't entitled to write about someone else's lived experience, that you need some kind of like identity badge in order to write a story about someone else's experience, whether it's a novel or journalism or what have you. And I really staunchly resist that as a proposition. I think that it's our job as writers to try and understand the lives of others and the minds of others. And so, you know, for instance, my second book, actually, that grew out of that piece that I pitched Daniel 20 years ago, was about Chinatown in New York City. It was about Chinese people coming from China to the US through human smuggling networks in the 1980s and 90s. And I'm not Chinese. I don't speak Mandarin or Fujianese, which is the language that a lot of these people spoke. None of that to me should mean that I can't write compellingly about these people. However, I think the price of admission, if you're going to trespass into someone else's life, is you have to get it right. You have to write it in a way that people from that culture will feel as though you really saw them and understood them. They'll recognize what you are portraying. And so with The Snakehead, that book, to this day, most of the people who read that book today are like the young American-born Chinese kids of the generation of people that I was writing about. And it means the world to me that they feel as though I captured it. But yeah, that's wherever I am. If I'm in India, if I'm in West Africa, if I'm in academia or you know, writing about the mafia or whatever it is, you have to feel as though you're sort of seeing these people and able to, it's strange because it's not that you're totally suspending judgment. I'm often quite judgmental when I'm writing about people. But in that moment of going out and reporting, when you meet the person in the bar, I want my mind and my heart to be totally open. I'm not coming in with, I'm not really coming in like a prosecutor, right? With a sense that, like, I have an angle here, I have an agenda, here's the way I see you. It's actually the opposite. In some ways, I'm sort of like, please, like, explain, show me why whatever preconceptions I have are wrong. Because as a writer, that's the thing that I want. It's the most thrilling thing for me as a reader is when I'm reading something and I kind of come in feeling one way and I come out feeling another. So I want to turn you around in that way. And in order to do that, I have to be open to being turned around myself.
Yeah, and I think in your work in particular, it shows that you can have that sort of identification with someone's humanity without being a big softy. Because, you know, like, I'm thinking of a piece that he once wrote about El Chapo, the you know, the drug dealer who did so many terrible things. I'm not even going to begin to discuss them. But he also was a very wily escapee and, you know, would escape from prisons with these kind of daring do, you know, kind of jury-rigged schemes in which bathtubs would suddenly lift with hydraulic lifts and he'd escape through tunnels. And, you know, the challenge of this piece after he was on the run and he had escaped was both to kind of allow the reader to recognize that there is a certain kind of scampy ingenuity to this drug lord. And at the same time, as you are recognizing that, fully reckon with the fact that it was a form of ambition and kind of personal fire that was destroying his country and laying waste to so many lives. And I think, you know, that's kind of one of the through lines of Patrick's work. I mean, if you read Empire of Pain, which is about the Sackler family, the very wealthy family that helped bring the gift of OxyContin to the world, the thing that is really interesting about the book for me, the article he wrote for the New Yorker by the same title had a similar quality in that it was, in many ways, about this family that like put its name on art museums and kind of had laundered its reputation almost by doing good works to the point that nobody often realized that they had like created this drug that had helped create the opioid crisis. But when you read the book, the man who invented OxyContin is like a Saul Bellow character. He is this like absolutely like genius of pharmaceutical marketing and perhaps dodginess, but he just goes forward and forward. You know, if you all remember that novel Valley of the Dolls and the kind of Valium era and Betty Ford, he was always there like a little pharmaceutical zealot, like finding his way through the kind of American neurotic life and finding ways to exploit it and make money off of it. And you can't help but almost kind of admire the genius of the guy, even though it's a dark genius. And I do think you're especially attracted to that kind of person. You know, the dumb villains he'll take a pass on, but the really, really kind of smart and complicated ones, that's who I kind of try to toss Patrick's way.
Yeah, I mean, because, I mean, to me, these are, listen, the reality is that to take Chapo Guzman as an example, I mean, awful, awful human being, right? Like in terms of our sort of moral evaluation of this person responsible for many, many, many thousands of deaths, untold thousands of deaths, a terrible person. Also, the CEO of effectively like a multi-billion dollar commodities business, you know, sending all these different drugs across the border into America. We've always had this kind of very myopic view, I think, of the drug war in America. We sort of feel as though, you know, these like crazy Mexicans keep fire hosing all these drugs across the border and we have no choice, poor little us, but to take them. And, you know, there's no sense of this as like a dynamic market that's driven by demand. There's a wonderful quote from a guy who was president of Mexico about a century ago. He said, "Poor Mexico, so far from God and so close to the United States." You know, the real problem, right, is that we are the biggest consumer of illegal drugs on the planet. I think the tail kind of wags the dog sometimes. But to take the Chapo example, I mean, you know, this is a story that I often trot out, but it's a good one. I wrote that piece about him without any cooperation from Guzman. He was locked up at the time in Mexico. And after it came out, I got a phone call from a lawyer for the Guzman family, which made me nervous. And I get a voicemail in the office, and before I called him back, I called one of my sources in law enforcement. I said, "Hey, I just need you to run this guy's name. Is he really a cartel lawyer?" And my guy called me back an hour later, and he said, "Yeah, I ran the traps. He's a cartel lawyer, all right. And he's one of these cartel lawyers who's like 60% cartel and 40% lawyer." So that made me even more nervous. And when I called the guy back, he surprised me by asking. He said they'd read the story, and he asked if I would like to ghostwrite El Chapo's memoirs.
Coming out in 2027, yeah, exactly. Historia.
Well, no, but here's the thing. To the point. So, I said no. Like I said no immediately, in part because I thought there's no way I was able to kind of maintain the cocktail in a 10,000 word piece where you've got like one part derring do and kind of fun south of the border, like prison breaks, and you know, he's this kind of this like bandit who you're almost rooting for. And then one part, like a genuine assessment of how dysfunctional the relationship between Mexico and the US is and the carnage and the bloodshed. Like the piece does not stint on that at all. And I could kind of keep that cocktail like in perfect tension for 10,000 words. And I thought there's no way I'd be able to do this if I did a book. Either it would tip into kind of valorizing him too much, or it would tip the other way and he might kill me. And to give you an example, like, you know, after I said no, Rolling Stone published this big, noteworthy, you know, first ever interview with Chapo Guzman by noted investigative reporter Sean Penn. And and it's the most ridiculous piece you've ever read. Like, the whole thing is like, he is a humble man with simple needs. You know, it's just like, it's everything that I would not have allowed myself to write. So I think it's, I mean, I'm all for keeping those things in tension, but I'm also mindful of the danger that things can tip one way or the other.
Yeah, and, you know, to go back to Say Nothing, and then we'll ask for some audience questions, you know, I think another thing that you know, are really interested in is not just telling the tale, but, you know, OxyContin, it has an after effect for decades. And with the Troubles, I mean, one of the stories that I always remember from that book is there's a moment where someone is, I think was one of the McConville kids, was a taxi driver. And, you know, so he's working in Belfast. And
no, he was the passenger.
That's right. Yeah. Okay, and so he gets into a car. And he suddenly realizes that, like, you know, he's in the car with somebody who may have been involved. And just imagine that. You know, you live in this city that in some ways is a big city, but it's also the tiniest world in which people who may have been involved with the killing of your mother and know that you can't talk about it even when you're sitting in the back of his taxi. I think, you know, for Patrick to recognize, like, that distills the way that history lives on in the people who kind of inherit a tragic conflict like the Troubles. You know, and that's what I appreciate in his writing, is finding a story like that that just shows you that, you know, it's not history. It's not just something for the scholarly books. It's for people who live it every day in the country where those passions are still felt. And even when they seem resolved, they're never fully resolved.
Yeah, I mean, just very quickly on that, you've been hearing about the Troubles, this grinding conflict that lasted 3 decades and was responsible for thousands of deaths, and that many, many people, and I remember this, I'm sure many of you did, thought would never end. And it ended. And I would say, without drawing any cheap analogies, there are other grinding situations around the world that people feel as though that people have kind of given up hope on, right? It is possible to end a war like this. What was so striking for me is that the peace in Northern Ireland is a cold piece. It's a brittle piece, but it's still a piece. The piece is held, right? And so the sort of inadvertent, like, poetry for me of the idea of Michael McConville, this kid who last saw his mother when he was 11 years old. She was taken away at gunpoint from that apartment. He was clinging to her legs, and he ends up in an orphanage, and he has not had an easy life. And as a middle-aged man, he gets into a taxi, a black taxi in Belfast, and he recognizes the driver as one of the men who took his mother away in 1972. But the really telling thing is he doesn't say anything. Yeah. And they just ride in silence. And I felt as though, you know, both of those men in that taxi are the beneficiaries of the Good Friday Agreement. And yet there's also a sense in which there's a kind of a metaphor in there, right? That they ride in silence. Neither of them can speak of it. And then Michael pays the man his fare and gets out. In some ways, I feel like that's all the people of Northern Ireland, right, are kind of trapped in that same situation. So,
yeah, absolutely. Well, thanks, Patrick.
You're listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. This conversation was recorded live on July 30th, 2025, and has been edited for broadcast. Today's show is the third in our 6-part series featuring speakers from the 2025 College of the Atlantic Summer Institute. Stay with us as New Yorker writer Patrick Radden Keefe, whose book Say Nothing, A True Story of Memory and Murder in Northern Ireland, inspired the new FX TV show, and his colleague Daniel Zalewski, executive editor of The New Yorker, take audience questions about the challenges of reporting this story.
Thank you for this. It's been wonderful. I find myself sitting here thinking, asking you, Patrick, how you deal with the moral dimension after you've been able to maintain the cocktail, and what thoughts you have about, are these bad people? Are they evil people? I don't know how to be articulate about it, but I'd love to have you riff a little bit on that.
So I think with a few exceptions, who are mostly people I haven't written about, that there aren't that many people who are just evil. I'm not totally interested in the concept of evil, kind of pure evil. I think most of us are flawed in one way or another. The people who are really interesting to me, I guess the question that is really interesting to me is that, you know, over the years I've done some screenwriting on the side. And there's a wonderful Hollywood adage for screenwriters, which is when you're writing your movie and you're writing your villain, it's important, if you want your villain to be a good villain, that you remember your villain doesn't know he's the villain, right? Like, he thinks he's the hero. Like, he's watching a whole other movie. And I have found that that's mostly the case, whether it's Chapo Guzman or the Sacklers, that people get up in the morning, they look at themselves in the mirror, and most of the time, it's these like small kind of angle, you know, these little gradations. People sort of slowly, they don't get off the kind of track of mainstream morality. It's not like they hop the track. It's this thing where they start deviating in small increments and they're able to tell themselves, I'm okay, I'm doing okay, there's a reason I'm doing this. And it just gets kind of more and more grotesque. So I don't, in a kind of strange way, if, you know, like, I can't tell you why Amy Bishop walked into a room and shot six of her colleagues. I think she's nuts. Maybe that is something closer to evil. Maybe she's just a very damaged person who had this terrible experience as a young person, and then everybody around her kind of denied that she'd shot her brother, and that secretly compounded it. I don't know. But the stories that are most interesting to me are these stories about people who often end up doing genuinely very evil things, but who at each step along the way are telling themselves, I'm okay, this is justified, here's why I'm doing what I'm doing. And I'm interested in the kind of range of reactions over time. So for instance, Dolores Price and Brandon Hughes, those two people from the IRA, both of them died alcoholic. She was addicted to drugs. They essentially, there was a wonderful quote that one of my sources gave me who knew them, who said they killed themselves for years. Like, they slowly, they couldn't deal with the things that they'd done, and they felt unable to justify them in retrospect. Jerry Adams, who's another big character in the book, to this day would look out at you and say, well, I don't feel any of that trauma because, you see, I was never in the IRA at all. Now, I don't know if Jerry Adams believes that. Like, nobody else believes that, right? But that's a story that he tells the world. I think on some level it may even be a story he tells himself. And he sleeps like a baby and doesn't feel bad about any of it. The Sacklers, if they were here with us today, would say, there's been a big misunderstanding, you know, honestly, like, I've seen the private text messages of the Sackler family. It was one of the little goodies I got when I was doing my reporting. And to hear them tell it, like, the biggest victims of the opioid crisis are the Sackler family, right? So I'm interested in the way in which people rationalize these things over time.
The only thing I'm just going to add to that is that another really interesting article of Patrick's from about 12 years ago in The New Yorker was a profile of Judy Clark, who defends people like Dmitry Sarnaev and other people who are being, you know, given on trial for death penalty and, you know, often called the worst of the worst. And it's a really fascinating exploration of somebody who day in, day out, you know, is working to defend people who everyone else considers to be irredeemable, and how she works through that. And I think there's a reason Patrick wanted to do that story. I think that, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I could go on about this all day, and I won't, I promise. There was one review when Say Nothing, the series, came out, which you should all watch. It's on Hulu. Emmy nominated as of a few weeks ago. There was one bad review. I thought we were going to get a bunch of these reviews in the English press specifically. Strangely enough, the one we got came in The Guardian, which is not where I would have predicted it, which said, how can you humanize these people? And to me, this is like a flatly absurd thing to say, right? Like, they are human beings. I think that there's a kind of there's a sort of comforting moral vanity in looking at people and saying, I could never be that person. There's no circumstances that could happen to me that would make me do what they did. I just think that's nonsense. I have very little interest in that. And so for me, yeah, it's very Judy Clark, the death penalty lawyer. She has to save the lives of these people she represents, who are awful people who've done terrible things. She has to persuade a jury this is a human, not a monster. They may be the author of terrible things, but they are nevertheless a human being.
Great. All the way in the back, we have one more.
Okay, sorry.
One more, and then we'll go.
Thank you. I was going to ask for you to expand on your comments about your perceptions of Jerry Adams. He comes across in your work as a revolutionary, a sellout, a megalomaniac, a very multifaceted portrayal. Can you comment a little bit more about your perceptions of him?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm really happy to hear you articulate it that way, because to me, Jerry Adams is like a hugely complicated figure, and that's part of what makes him so appealing as a subject. I get annoyed sometimes when people talk about Say Nothing and they describe Jerry Adams as the villain of the book, because I don't think of him that way at all. I think that Adams was an incredible leader. I think he was a revolutionary leader. I think that he, in that capacity, authorized a series of really atrocious things in the name of a cause that he believed to be just. And he eventually makes this pivot where he starts denying that he was ever in the IRA, which drives the people who worked for him in the IRA crazy. It drives them bananas, because they feel like, well, you're the guy who gave me the orders. Like, when do you get to say, well, I was never me. I didn't have anything to do with that. You know, now we have to live with it. But the thing that's so fascinating is that I think the fact that he did that came from a few places. One of them was that I think Jerry Adams, in a way that very few others could in the IRA, really early on, was able to see around the corner. He saw, we are not going to fight the British into the sea. This is going to end in some kind of negotiated political settlement. So first of all, we need a political track running in tandem with the military track. Then I think he saw, we need to start a peace process. And we have to start it secretly, because if the IRA writ large knew that you were starting to think about what a peaceful resolution and disarmament would look like, they might kill you, right? So he starts to do that. And ultimately, he becomes this guy who is dealing with a series of interlocutors on the international stage who I think kind of benefit from the ambiguity about whether or not he was ever in the IRA. It's like, of course, he was in the IRA. But I think the fact that he had that kind of a form of plausible deniability ends up becoming politically quite helpful. So I think a ruthless guy, I think a total situationalist with a kind of with a little strain of sociopathy, who absolutely lied and continues to lie and sold out his friends and what have you. I also think a visionary who helped achieve a piece that we should all be celebrating and in part crediting him with today.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's program was the third in a six-part series from the 2025 College of the Atlantic Summer Institute and featured a discussion between author and journalist Patrick Radden Keefe and editor Daniel Zalewski, both of The New Yorker, about Patrick's reporting on a murder in Northern Ireland during the Troubles. This talk was recorded July 30th, 2025, in Bar Harbor, Maine. It was edited for broadcast. Today's episode is available on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on Shows to find Speaking in Maine and many other on-demand programs. Music in this hour comes from Our Alarm Clock. Susan Tran is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine, and today's program was produced by me, Jane Donahue. Thanks for joining us. This is Maine Public Radio.